This is a Puritan and Reformed audiobook podcast, and on Sermon Audio, the Puritan Reformed Church of America. The following is a reading of a book that I discovered from Grace Audio Treasures on Sermon Audio, called Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation, especially concerning the theater by Samuel Milton Vernon. But I'm going to start by finishing something from the last podcast, and that is Christian Progress by John Angel James, and this is number 9, A Taste for Worldly Amusements, will inevitably prove, wherever it is indulged, a powerful obstacle to growth in grace. Man is unquestionably made for enjoyment. He has a capacity for bliss, an instinctive appetite for gratification, and for this God has made ample provision of a healthful and lawful kind, a taste for pleasure means something different from this, or at any rate, it means this directed to wrong sources or carried to an excess. Now, there are some amusements which in their very nature are so utterly incompatible with true religion that a liking for them and a hankering after them, and especially an indulgence in them, cannot comport with real, earnest, and serious piety. The convivial parties of the glutton and the drunkard and the passion for the gambling table, the pleasures of the race course and the performance of the theater are all of this kind. A taste for them is utterly uncongenial with the spirit of godliness. So is the love for the carefree and fashionable entertainments of the ballroom and the routs and parties of genteel life. These are all unfriendly to religion and are usually renounced by persons intent upon the momentous concerns of eternity. A love for them dies out from the soul agitated and made anxious by the great question, what shall I do to be saved? We would not doom to perdition all who are at any time found in this round of worldly pleasure, but we unhesitatingly say that a taste for them is entirely opposed to the whole genius of Christianity. They are all included in that world which is overcome by faith and a new birth. Religion is, though a happy, a very serious thing, and can no more live and flourish in the heated atmosphere of those parties than could a plant brought from the frigid or temperate zone under the burning rays of a tropical sun. But in this pleasure-loving, pleasure-seeking, and pleasure-inventing age, there is a great variety of amusements perpetually rising up which it would be impossible to say they are sinful and therefore unlawful. Yet the supposition of their lawfulness, viewed in connection with their abundance, variety, and constant repetition, is the very thing that makes them dangerous to the spirit of true religion. A taste for even lawful worldly amusements, which leads its possessor to be fond of them, seeking them and longing for them, shows a mind that is in a very doubtful state as to vital piety. It looks as if he had not yet entered into the Savior's words to the woman of Samaria, whosoever drinks of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst, but the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life, John 4:13-14. Now the thirsting after worldly pleasure of any kind would seem as if the subject of it had not yet drank of the living water from the well of salvation. This anxiety after innocent worldly gratification seems to indicate that the peace which passes all understanding had not yet taken possession of the soul. And this inquiry, who will show us any good, hardly comports with a mind that had said to God, Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us. Thou hast put gladness in my heart more than in the time that their corn and their wine increased, Psalm 4:6-7. I do not like to be asked, as I sometimes am, the question whether such and such amusements are compatible with religion. That is, I do not like it when it evidently proceeds from a prevailing wish to enjoy them, and a desire to get ministerial sanction for indulging in them. It ought not to be necessary to prove that many of these are unlawful. They should be found unnecessary. I am aware that it is sometimes pleaded on behalf of worldly amusements by young people that abstinence from them represents piety as clothed with austerity and as a species of penance, and that religious people should go as far as they can in these things to disprove the calumny. There is something perhaps in this, but it requires to be very narrowly watched. For without caution, see how far it would carry us. They who indulge in pleasures which no religious person could ever engage in, may say that all persons must have a very melancholy religion who debarred themselves of their pleasures. So that an excessive repugnance to all amusements, and the repugnance may, I concede, be excessive and almost ridiculous, should not be so beaten down as to make way for a latitude which would be dangerous to personal godliness. A Christian is not to partake of the pleasures of the world to prove that his religion does not debar him from enjoyment, but he is to let it be seen by his peace that passes understanding, and his joy unspeakable and full of glory, that his religion gives far more enjoyment than it takes away, that in fact it gives him the truest happiness. The way to win a worldly person to religion is not to go and partake of his amusements, but to prove to him that we are happier with our pleasures than he is with his, that we bask in sunshine while he has only a smoking taper, that we have found the river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and the Lamb, while he is drinking of the muddy streams which issue from the earth. And now in this podcast, I want to move quickly on to this book called Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation by Samuel Milton Vernon, specifically about the theater, and written in the year 1882, before there were any movies of the kind that we see today. Chapter 5, Testimony Concerning the Character of the Theater. We are now to examine the character of this ancient institution, whose whitened locks, as it stands before us clad in the robes of its own history, might awaken our veneration were it not for the blood spots on its hands, the demon leer in its eye, and the foul odors from its filthy raiment proclaiming it one of the vile monsters that still lingers on the earth because mankind have not had virtue enough to exterminate it. We will proceed by the fair and rational method of calling in competent witnesses, who have known and studied the institution, to testify as to the character of the accused for common virtue. Passing by the great lights of the Christian Church, the martyrs, the regenerators of the nations, and the godly fathers and mothers whose voices would of course be against the accused, passing all those who have made the theater a source of gain as actors, managers, or advocates, knowing that a gift perverts judgment, I will go into the world's high courts of philosophers, thinkers, and sages, and ask the men revered by all ages to testify of the theater. The first I introduce with an apology to the reader for presenting a pagan, and with a request to the witness to be careful to say nothing to shock the fine moral sensibilities of my Christian reader, is a philosopher, Plato. Hear him. Quote, "The diversions of the stage are dangerous to the temper and sobriety of mind. They rouse the feelings of anger and desire too much. Tragedy is prone to render men boisterous, and comedy makes them buffoons. Thus, those passions are cherished which ought to be checked. Virtue loses ground and reason becomes uncertain. Let us try another pagan, even though our Christian cheeks were made to tingle by the words uttered by the master thinker Plato. Here comes Aristotle, one of the world's greatest thinkers, dominating pagan and Christian thought for many centuries, a man who saw deep into the soul and inner life of things. He declares, quote, "The law ought to forbid young people the seeing of comedies till they are proof against debauchery," end quote. Solon, the wisest of the Greeks and their lawgiver, forbade theatrical exhibitions as pernicious to the popular mind. But let us turn from these ancient dreaming Greeks to the more modern and common-sense Romans and hear what they have to say. The first shall be the greatest thinker of them all, the prince of orators, the powerful advocate, the versatile and elegant writer, the incorruptible patriot, the savior and the glory of Rome, Cicero. He declares, quote, "Comedy subsists on lewdness," end quote. A short sentence, but a lightning stroke from a brain surcharged with truth, the shock of which is still felt by the forces of evil. We next invite the great historian Livy to the stand, and ask him in his calm, deliberate way to tell us what occurred under one of the Scipios, throwing light upon the subject. He says, quote, "A theater was being erected under the direction of the censors, and Scipio Nasica urged in a motion or decree before the Senate that the theater was a useless establishment and its exhibitions destructive of good morals. By these and similar reasons, the Senate, feeling themselves to be the guardians of the welfare and virtue of the citizens, passed a decree which leveled the walls of the unfinished theater to the ground," end quote. It is also said that all their materials were sold by a common crier. The Senate passed a law that there should be no benches allowed for the audience in any theater within a mile of the city. We may lift our hands in holy horror at this infringement of liberty, but remember, dear reader, these were unenlightened pagans, and it is highly probable they knew no better, the light of the 19th century not having yet dawned. Seneca, the great heathen moralist, says, quote, "Nothing is so injurious to good morals as the loitering in theaters, for then vice makes an insensible approach and steals upon us in the disguise of pleasure," end quote. Rome has other witnesses ready to testify, but I wave them aside as nothing they could say would add to the overwhelming force of the testimony already given. If anything more is desired, read it in the history of the growth of theaters and gladiatorial exhibitions in Rome as its virtue declined and its fall approached. Read it in the light of that conflagration kindled by the bloody Nero, a patron of the theater and an actor on the stage. Read it in the words of the master historian Chabannes, who, among the causes of the fall of Rome, names the corruption of the people by theatrical exhibitions and shows. Let no one attempt to break the force of these testimonies by saying that they do not apply to the case in hand, since they allude to the ancient theater, which all must confess was corrupt. The elegant writer Joseph Addison gives the following testimony upon the corrupt character of the English theater as compared with the Greek and Roman, quote, "Were our English stage but half so virtuous as that of the Greeks and Romans, we should quickly see the influence of it in the behavior of all the politer part of mankind. It is one of the most unaccountable things that the lewdness of our theater should be so much complained of, so well exposed, and so little redressed." From the Christian Spectator, page 446. From the days of Addison till now, the critics have not ceased to bewail the continued demoralization of the theater. If we descend to modern times, we do not find the advanced age of the institution winning for it that respect of the good and great which they are accustomed to bestow upon virtuous old age. If we may accept the testimony of those most to be trusted, the theater grows worse rather than better as it grows older, a strong indication that its character is essentially bad. Sir Matthew Hale, one of England's most honored sons, says, quote, "that when he was at Oxford University, he made great proficiency in his studies. But the stage players coming there, he was so much corrupted that he almost entirely forsook his studies. He then came to the solemn resolution that while he lived, never would he again enter into a theater." William Wilberforce, known and honored wherever freedom unfurls her banner, affirms, quote, "The debauchee, the sensualist, the profane, have ever found in the theater their chosen resort for enjoyment." He asks, "How can a virtuous mind seek pleasure in such a place, amid such companions, and from such persons as the actors and actresses are generally known to be?" End quote. Sir John Tompkins, in his Life of Dr. Johnson, remarks, quote, "The playhouse is a very hotbed of vice, and wherever planted becomes surrounded by a halo of brothels. I have thus called up the men most honored and revered to testify of the character of this institution, and they give it with united voice such a character as should deny it the patronage and company of every virtuous and right-minded person. There are many utterances by the legislative and judicial bodies of England and America showing the character of the theater in the opinion of patriots and thinkers in most recent times. An English judge, in charging a jury in London, said, 'One playhouse ruins more souls than 50 churches are able to save,'" end quote. Judge Bulstrode, charging the jury of Middlesex, London, April 12, 1718. In 1778, when the American colonies struggling for independence felt their dependence upon God and their need of his aid, Congress passed a law providing for the dismissal from office of any officer of the United States who should be found in attendance upon a theater. Soon after the Declaration of Independence, the following resolution was adopted by Congress, quote, "Whereas true religion and good morals are the only solid foundation of public liberty and happiness, resolved, that it be and is hereby earnestly recommended to the several states to take the most effective measures for the encouragement thereof and the suppression of theatrical entertainments, horse racing, gaming, and such other diversions as are productive of idleness, dissipation, and a general depravity of principles and manners. Our municipal governments have been compelled to pass very stringent laws to protect society against the evil classes and influences that gather about and go out from the theater." Chapter 6, The Testimony of the Church. If pagan philosophers, poets, and historians speak of the theater, as we have heard them in the last chapter, what may we expect of the Church of Christ but indignant denunciation when it comes in sheep's clothing, pretending to be the friend of virtue and seeking Christian patronage? With only an occasional exception, the Church has faithfully witnessed against the monstrous iniquities nourished and propagated under this assumed ministry of the fine arts. It must be confessed with pain that the Roman Catholic and the Greek churches have not stood unitedly with the Reformed churches in their opposition to this great evil. In nominal Christian countries, where the Sabbath is a holiday, given up to games, concerts, and theatrical exhibitions, in which even the priests participate, we cannot expect to find a lively conscience on this subject. And yet even here in time of Lent or great religious solemnities and among the orders making special claims to sanctity and religious earnestness, the theater is forbidden. Among the Reformed churches where the Sabbath is held sacred, where a personal religious life is enjoined and cultivated, and where vigorous efforts are made for the salvation of the souls of men, there is but one voice in regard to the theater. John Calvin exterminated it in Geneva and gave the Presbyterian conscience such a decided tonic on this question that ever since this day when you find a good, true Presbyterian, you find an uncompromising foe of the theater. John Knox did for Scotland what Calvin did for Geneva and the continent of Europe, and the Scotch Presbyterians are a solid phalanx against the theater. Whatever may be true of particular congregations or communities, the Presbyterian Church has stood like an iron wall against the theater and all the grosser worldly amusements. There are always some people who are neither one thing nor the other on any question, and though the Presbyterian Church is an uncomfortable place for such people, a few of them may have strayed in there. The early Methodists imbibed the spirituality of the Quakers, the strict morality of the Puritans, and the conscientiousness of the Presbyterians, cementing these qualities together with the best parts of the ritual of the Church of England into a strong worldwide century-enduring structure which has always been understood as the house of the Lord, having no fellowship with the theater. John Wesley found the clergy of his day attending Sunday afternoon races and games, going with the people to the playhouse while the masses were given over to worldliness and vice, with no man to care for their souls. Against this condition of things, he lifted his voice in loud and earnest protest. As a large denomination of which he, under God, was a founder, has not ceased to do to this day. Methodism has always been a foe to the playhouse, more by its general spirit of earnest piety than by special enactments. To be a soundly converted Methodist, quote, going on unto perfection, end quote, to be happy in religion, faithful to the class meaning, an earnest and revival work for the salvation of souls has been considered within and without the church as involving, as a matter of course, strong hostility to the theater. The general rule in the Book of Discipline forbidding, quote, the taking such diversions as cannot be used in the name of the Lord Jesus, end quote, has always been interpreted as the condemnation of the theater. In a general conference held in Brooklyn in 1872, a more explicit rule was adopted forbidding attending theaters. The Baptists stand side by side with the Methodists and the Presbyterians while the congregations and Episcopalians are not far behind in the war against, quote, Satan's chapel, the theater. An English writer in the time of Charles II made a catalog of authorities against the stage, which contains every name of eminence in the heathen and Christian world. It comprehends the united testimony of the Jewish and Christian churches, the deliberate acts of 54 ancient and modern, general, national, and provincial councils and synods, both of the Western and Eastern churches, the condemnatory sentence of 71 ancient fathers and 150 modern Catholic and Protestant authors. It may be useful here to give the utterances of a few of its great leaders to show the opinion of the Church in regard to this institution. Clement called it the chair of pestilence. Augustine calls it a cage of uncleanness and a public school of debauchery. Archbishop Tillotson, speaking of the conduct of certain parents, says, "There are such monsters, I had almost said devils, as not to know how to give their children good things. Instead of bringing them to God's church, they bring them to the devil's chapels, playhouses, places of debauchery, those schools of lewdness and vice." John Wesley says, "A theater not only saps the foundation of all religion, but also tends to drinking and debauchery." These testimonies given without a bribe and with no conceivable reason for their utterance, save the conscientious convictions of these eminent servants of God, must have great weight with all right-minded persons as to the relation of the theater to spiritual religion and good morals. Pollock says, "A theater was from the very first a favorite haunt of sin, though honest men, some very honest, wise, and worthy men, maintained it might be turned to good account, and so perhaps it might, but never was. From first to last it was an evil place. And now such things were acted there as made the demons blush, and from the neighborhood angels and holy men trembling, retired." Chapter 7 from the book Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation by Samuel Milton Vernon, the well-known character of actors and actresses, an objection to the theater. If it can be shown that the maintenance of the theater requires the corruption of a large class of men and women as actors, who for hire are required to appear in scenes on the stage and in the green room, that surely undermine virtue, every pure mind must look upon it with horror, even if it were possible to show, as it is not, that the contagion could not possibly spread from actors to auditors. No Christian man who will stop to think of the matter can consent to contribute the price of a ticket to the fund necessary to hire men and women to live lives of shame and folly. The man who pays a price in such a transaction is as guilty as he who accepts it. The giver and the receiver of bribes stand on the same moral footing. It is not here assumed that every actor is a vile person, nor that virtue is necessarily excluded from the stage. I gladly recognize and proclaim the fact that there have been commendable examples of integrity and virtue among actors, the more conspicuous and the more to be lauded because of the difficulties overcome. I assume that their profession is such as to demoralize, degrade, and corrupt the character, and therefore he must be a paragon of virtue who keeps himself pure in it. If the ministers, the physicians, or the judges of the land were to turn actors and go upon the stage, 10 years would probably find them as corrupt as the present occupants of the stage. I have not a word against the unfortunate class driven, beguiled, or howsoever brought to this profession, but I have maledictions and curses for the institution that has corrupted and destroyed them, and sorrowful rebuke and condemnation for the professing Christian who have contributed to the funds that bribed them to their shame and ruin. It is not strange that actors become corrupt. The man who simulates a feeling or emotion he does not possess, who for a price by strength of will or power over his feelings raises abnormal passions and emotions to entertain and please, or who sells himself to act an unreal part on the stage or in the open field of life, sets at naught and defies those laws of God and of human nature by which good and strong characters are formed. To assume that a man may act a part of a deception, fraud, hypocrisy, cruelty, murder, intemperance, and debauchery, and do it well, with heart and brain, fully awake and active in this theme, and not be corrupted by it, is a monstrous absurdity. History, no less than common sense and philosophy, teaches us that when one sells himself to play the clown or the mock hero for public amusement, he trails the flag of virtue and grasps hands with infamy. Cicero, in his treatise De Republica, informs us that Rome passed a decree by which, quote, common players were expelled their tribe, and like the felons of our penitentiaries, deprived forever of all rights of citizenship, end quote. Another decree was passed called the Praetorian Edict, that whoever appears on the stage to speak or act is declared infamous, end quote. The laws of England from a very early period until recently spoken of actors as rogues, vagabonds, and sturdy beggars. These edicts and laws express sufficiently the verdict of history as to the character of this profession. Those who complain most bitterly of such an arraignment are the first to justify and emphasize it when the occasion arrives. In a fashionable boarding house on Fifth Avenue, New York City, there were a number of wealthy ladies very fond of the theater, of which they were regular patrons. There was also a young lady in the same house of fine personal qualities, good character, and ladylike deportment. It became known to our theater-loving ladies that the young lady was preparing for the stage. Their indignation rose so high that they waited on the proprietor and informed him that the young lady must leave the house or they would, on the ground that it would injure their reputations, for it to be known that they associated with one who was preparing for the stage. Nothing was alleged against the young lady's character, but the well-known character of actors and actresses and the sentiments of the public was such that they felt themselves in danger from the presence of one in the house who was even preparing for the stage. The common feeling is that when a young man or a young lady goes on the stage, they are lost to good society. There is not a mother who would not rather bury her daughter than give her to the green room and the stage. The common sentiment has a basis of facts to rest upon, and society refuses to receive actors unless vouched for, because, as a class, they have earnest distrust and suspicion. A bold and fearless announcement of these facts ought to be kept before the public, if for no other purpose to save, if possible, the multitude of stage-struck young girls and boys to be found in every theater-going community, many of whom are so unfortunate as to have silly, foolish parents who seem not to know or care that their children are on the way to shame and death. Let the ministry imitate the Christian heroism and fidelity of the noble Canon Wilberforce in Westminster Abbey on the occasion of Sarah Bernhardt's visit to London, when he said, quote, "She has dared to come to London, bringing her illegitimate children with her and flaunting her skirts in the very face of royalty." Then turning to the Prince of Wales, he said, "It is the nation's disgrace that Britain's future king should so far forget what belongs to the dignity of his station that he should visit this woman in the theater green room and speak face to face to her in flattering words," end quote. Then in closing, the canon said, "Oh, how deeply virtuous England regrets the premature death of the good prince consort. Had he been living today, this could never have happened." The strongest testimonies to the truth of these remarks upon the character of actors as a class come from the honorable men and women whose exceptional purity and integrity in the profession have retained for it the respect which still lingers to some degree among the intelligent and pure-minded. The modern stage has no brighter ornament for splendid abilities and pure character than Edwin Booth. He declares that he does not, quote, "permit his wife and daughter to see a play without previously ascertaining its character," end quote. That the theater has become, quote, "a mere shop for gain, open to every huckster of immoral gimcricks." This well-known criticism of modern plays and actors, as well as those of the great army of critics who make this their business, are quite as severe as any I have made in these pages. Charles Sprague thus expresses the corruption of the stage and its actors as it appeared to him, quote, "Lo, where the stage, the poor, degraded stage, holds its warped mirror to a gaping age, there were to raise the drama's moral tone, full harlequin usurps Apollo's throne. There where grown children gather round to praise the new vamped legends of their nursery days, where one loose scene shall turn more souls to shame than 10 of Channing's lectures can reclaim. There where in idiot rapture we endure the herded vagabonds of every shore, women unsexed who lost to women's pride, the drunkard stagger ape, the bully stride, pert lisping girls who still in childhood fetters, babble of love yet barely know their letters, neat painted mummers mocking nature's shape to prove how nearly man can match an ape, vaulters who rightly served at home perchance had dangled from the rope on which they dance, dwarfs, mimics, jugglers, all that yield content, where sin holds carnival and wit keeps Lent, where shoals on shoals a modest million rush, one sex to laugh, the one to try to blush, when mincing ravenot sports tight pantalettes, and turns fops heads while turning pirouettes, there at each ribald sally where we hear the knowing giggle and the scurrile cheer, while from the intellectual gallery first rolls the bass plaudit loudest at the worst. My argument then is that the circus, the theater, or any other institution which maintains itself by corrupting the persons it employs, is of necessity vile in character, and is an agency employed by the Prince of Darkness for the ruin of the souls of man. And further, that whoever puts funds into the hands of such an institution is particeps criminis, and is jointly responsible for paying the devil's price for a service he cannot get without it. Chapter 8 from the book Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation. And remember, this was written in 1882 by Samuel Milton Vernon. Where does that leave us in the year 2015? The characters of the plays in use. It is freely conceded that the theater is not necessarily evil, but I am not dealing with ideals or supposable possibilities, nor with abstract theories, but with a visible fact and reality, a tangible something called the theater, which touches the everyday life of the masses in our great cities, which every man may put under the microscope or into the crucible and study for himself. The evil is not in the curtains, the costumes, the scenery, the stage, nor the acting. Neither is it wholly in the fact that the only object is to amuse and entertain. It is chiefly in the fact that immoral and impure plays are put upon the stage, corrupting both actors and auditors. Take the popular pieces for a season in any of our cities. Analyze and study them, and what are they? I will not even give you the name or outline of any one of them, but if you doubt the truth of what I am about to say, I challenge you to buy them, which you can do anywhere, for 10 or 15 cents apiece, and examine for yourself. Footnote. Dr. J. M. Buckley, editor of the Christian Advocate, New York, made a careful examination of more than 60 plays produced in the best theaters of New York during 3 years, and gives a result of his research in his admirable book on Christians in the Theater. More than 50 of these plays he declares to be corrupt, and sustains this assertion by giving the names and outlines of some of the most popular of the number. Dr. Herrick Johnson made a similar study of the plays presented in the 4 best theaters of Chicago in the fall and winter of 1881, and published the results in his plain talk about the theater. At Hooley's, 13 evenings were given to the so-called standard drama, and 76 evenings to trash. At McVicker's, 12 evenings were given to Miss Anderson, 6 to Joe Jefferson, 12 to Denham Thompson, and 48 to trash. At Haverly's, 18 evenings to the standard drama, and 51 to trash. At the Grand Opera, all the 79 evenings to trash, end quote. In the 3 best theaters of Indianapolis for the winter of 1881 and 2, the showing is even worse, the aggregate being 10 nights for the legitimate drama and 107 for what Dr. Johnson calls trash. If the best theaters are thus corrupt, what may be said of the others? End quote. You will find the majority of these studies in vice, shrewd apologies for crime, an attempt to make shame honorable, to give lying and falsehood the respect due to truth, to give robbery and theft the immunity and protection claimed for honesty, to elevate the profligate rake to a favorite of society, and to make the seducer a gallant hero, and to subvert the whole order set up in God's law by a pure Christian society. The heroes of the stage are eminent as they excel in irregularities, in cunning duplicity, prodigality, and passion. These are the qualities set forth in the most favorable light, securing favor, preferment, and prosperity. While virtue, honesty, sobriety, and piety are made ridiculous by being associated with stupidity and dullness in some blockhead, with shameless hypocrisy, or with disheartening misfortune and failure, the man of low, base character is always revealing some expected noble quality, while a man of professed virtue and religion always surprises you by some base deed or by downright hypocrisy. Vice is hailed with applause, virtue with hisses. Gambling, drunkenness, profanity, and libertinism are considered as chivalric weaknesses, rather to be regretted and yet to be expected, quote, in a really good fellow, while intelligence is ranked as cool villainy. Honesty is stupidity, virtue is an outward garb for greater security and vile practices, and religion is a sham and pretense. It is precisely on the plane of the argument criminals always make in their defense. The thief says, quote, all men steal, the merchant in a mean, sneaking way, by overcharging, I in an open, manly way, end quote. So says the play. The gambler says, I use my brain power just as a lawyer or the physician. For after all, every business is but a game of chance. Therefore, all men are gamblers in some form. The libertine says, there is no such thing as virtue. The only difference is some are a little more discreet than others. These are the principles taught in most of the popular plays, and they are the principles discussed in the haunts of bad men and vile women wherever found. Such teaching tends to destroy the very idea of virtue, to wreck all confidence in human nature, to obliterate moral distinctions and infiltrates in this soft, subtle way the ideas of debauchery and crime. The sublime plays of Shakespeare will not hold an average theater audience, and when presented, it must be with such an accompaniment as makes the appeal to the lower and baser nature, not found in the words of the great master by which the patronage of the multitudes is maintained. If anyone supposes this to be an extreme view, the result of hasty or partial investigation, let him consider the strong words of a great scholar and writer, who surely will not be accused of being a Puritan. In Taine's chapter on the theater of Charles II, we have these words, quote, the audiences of Shakespeare and Beaumont and Fletcher were in that transient and strained condition in which the imagination, adult and pure, laden with desire, curiosity, force develops man all at once, and in that man the most exquisite feelings. The roisterers took the place of these. Authors laid it down as a rule that all women were impudent hussies and all men were brutes. Debauchery in their hands became a matter of course, nay more, a matter of good taste. They profess it. Rochester and Charles II could quit the theater highly edified, more convinced than they were before that virtue was only a pretense, the pretense of clever rascals who wanted to sell themselves dear, end quote. Henry Ward Beecher, who I think will not be accused of Puritanism, in commenting on these words says, quote, some devils are even blacker than they are painted. This one was blacker than he can be painted, and it took less than a century for the drama to descend from Shakespeare to Wycherley. Keep on the safe side of certainty. He that doubts is condemned if he eats. Avoid the dangerous. If you do not know whether to go or stay at home, stay at home. It is better sometimes to go hungry than to eat poisoned food. The evil of a licentious picture does not depart when the eye turns from it. The photograph remains in the brain. The evil of a vicious suggestion does not depart when the bell rings down the curtain. No man can touch pitch and not be defiled. It is better to lose all of Shakespeare than to suffer the contagion for a single night of some of the modern dramas, end quote. And now I return to John Angel James' work on Christian progress, hindrances, amusements. After all, it is freely admitted that religion is not hostile to anything which is not hostile to it, that many things which are not religion, though not opposed to it, may be lawfully enjoyed by the Christian, that what he has to do in this manner is not to practice total abstinence, but moderation, yet he should remember how elastic a term moderation is. and to be vigilant lest his moderation should continually increase its latitude till it is swelled into the imperial tyranny of an appetite, which acknowledges no authority and submits to no restraint. Address to the reader. If in an important mission, journey, or undertaken of any kind, you were impeded in reference to the object contemplated, you would inquisitively and anxiously search for the cause of delay, and never rest satisfied till you had found and removed it. I am now supposing there is a hindrance of one or more kinds to your progress towards heaven, to your increase of faith and holiness. There are stones in the way to be gathered out. It is a fearful idea to think of hindrances to heaven, impediments to holiness. If there were anything that hindered your health or prosperity in business, or the success of any earthly scheme whatever, how earnestly you would ask the question, what is it? What is it? How thankful you would be to the friends who pointed it out, and how diligently you would set to work to take it out of the way. Well, there are impediments in your way to Zion. You are hindered. You do not perhaps make progress. How is this? I say to you what the apostle did to the Galatians. Who did hinder you, or what? Look back through this chapter. Take up every particular say of each. Is it this or this that stops my progress? I ask you and I implore you to ask yourself. Is it indifference to the subject? Is it the unsubdued corruption of your nature left to itself unresisted, unmortified? Is it an easily besetting sin? Is it one of the mistakes mentioned in the last chapter? Is it the peculiarity of your situation being unfriendly to a life of piety? Is it unsuitable companionship? Is it the inconsistencies of professing Christians? Is it a taste for worldly amusements? Is it persecution? Examine, I beseech you. Examine what it is that arrests you in your course and take it away. Again, I say, gather out the stones. Thank you for tuning in to the Puritan and Reformed audiobook, Progress. This has been a reading of John Angel James, Christian Progress, and also Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation. The next chapter is called The Moral Influences of the Theater, from the book Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation. There is about every person an institution, an indefinable something called moral influence. Like the odor from a flower garden or a mass of putrefaction, it penetrates the surrounding atmosphere, and though invisible and intangible, it is distinctly recognized and felt. It may not be traced to any single act or element of character. It may be the mystic aroma of hidden unseen qualities, but like a deadly malaria floating about in invisible particles in the air, it may carry death to the most healthy, robust natures. The oldest and wisest teachers of the race, fathers, mothers, and philosophers, have all warned the young against the danger of evil associations that would bring them into contact with vice, real or represented. If God had not spoken upon the subject, we would need but to look about at the wide-spreading, desolate ruins where the fires of passion, kindled by a spark from a neighboring conflagration, have eaten up everything that was beautiful or of value, leaving only ashes and blackened walls, for the most eloquent proclamation of the truth on this subject. We are by nature strongly inclined to the imitation of others. And if passion or impulse aid this inclination, its strength is doubled. And if the fiery impetuosity and indiscretion of youth add vehemence to the passion, it will be well nigh uncontrollable. We are strongly affected by what we see, the image of a thing painted on the retina of the eye, thence transferred to the mind and to the heart. The image of a thing is next to the reality, and hence it is that the image of vice, acted or real, carried through the eye to the mind and heart, makes such a powerful impression, and so often like a living seed lodged in the warm soil of the heart, springs up into reality after the kind of that from which it sprang. To look upon vice must have one of two effects, either to corrupt the mind, securing its toleration, at least so far that it will silently look upon it, or it will strengthen the soul in virtue by arousing its indignation and protest against it. How is it possible to sit by the hour watching the development of an intrigue of unholy love, of robbery, or murder, seasoned with profanity and coarse vulgarity, to seek it by choice, knowing beforehand the character of the play and not be corrupted by it? To sit by silently of choice while scenes of vice are being enacted, with no protest against them, is to aid them with our assent and sanction. The attendant upon church services is understood to sanction and approve them by his presence, and to contribute his influence toward making effectual the principles there taught. And the same is true of attendance upon the theater. What mind can look upon the half-dress, the indecent attitude and postures, the lascivious looks and embraces, and the unfolding of a plot for the corruption and overthrow of the pure and innocent, uttering not a word of protest nor withdrawing from it as from a fatal contagion, and remain untainted? The old lines of Pope are so true to human nature and history as to be worthy of being inscribed over the doorway of every theater as a warning to all who enter. Vice is a monster of so frightful mien as to be hated, needs but to be seen, yet seen to all familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. To consent to look upon vice without a protest against it is the first step to moral degeneracy. The young may be pure as angels, as their parents and friends claim for them, but they have passions and propensities quietly slumbering, innocent and inoffensive as gunpowder when let alone. But one spark of fire from a like passion and another may produce an explosion rending into fragments all that was beautiful and lovely. A gentleman of distinction testifies to what has been the experience of vast numbers of young men. When a boy, he spent some time in a city with a friend, giving some 15 minutes one night to looking upon vile scenes. He says the poison took effect. The sin left its mark. I cannot erase the effects of the impure thoughts which in that quarter of an hour were lodged in my heart, and which, may God forgive me, I harbored there. I can and do pray against the sin, and for God's grace to conquer it. But it is a thorn in my flesh, and still causes me great bitterness and anguish. Young men, as a lover of your souls, I tell you in all sincerity that there is nothing which I would not willingly give to have the veil of oblivion cast over those corrupt scenes and sentiments which still haunt me like foul specters. A few minutes in a pest house may be enough to blight the whole life, and one touch of impurity may poison the soul for time and eternity. It is no credit to a man's head or to his heart for him to say he can look upon such scenes unmoved. Human nature is the very same everywhere. And my complaint is not that men allow themselves to be moved by such scenes, so much as that they allow them to come into their presence. Unless one is naturally deficient, made of putty rather than of tingling nerves and delicate sensibilities, what moves the common mass of men will move him. For the most gifted and highly endowed are often the most sensitive and capable of impressions. It is the design of the play to excite the emotions and raise the passions, and if in any case it fails, it must be because the actors have overestimated the intelligence and capacities of the audience. A good listener, like a good actor, must enter into the spirit of the piece, follow the actor in his feelings, passions, and sentiments, and for the time, by the power of his imagination, transform fiction into reality. He is a dull, stupid, soulless fellow who looks upon the scenes of the stage with no kindling feelings or rising passions. One is forcibly said of the stage, wickedness is made to give amusement. Lying, drunkenness, and adultery are made a cause of sport and the occasion of hilarity, and crimes that would call down the wrath of God on their perpetrators are systematically made to provoke laughter. Laughing at crime is a mild way of taking in its infection, and a sure approach to a reconciliation and lasting friendship with it. If two people who have long been bitter enemies can be brought to indulge in a hearty laugh together, what remains necessary to a reconciliation will be easily disposed of. An uncorrupted mind has only scorn for vice, and has already fallen in feeling when it consents to laugh at it. This silent, insensible, indirect influence is one of the most deadly and dangerous forces of evil. Vice will rarely succeed in a bold, open attack upon virtuous minds. It will be rejected with scorn. It may, however, by soft, gentle, and sensible approaches, accustom the mind to its presence, soften resentment, insinuate its charms, blind the eyes to its character and consequences, and at last win marvelous victories over nature supposed to be proof against it. The continual dropping of water will change the face of solid granite. These positions are sustained by the testimony of theater-goers, that what at first greatly shocked them, they come directly to view unmoved and with perfect indifference, showing the deterioration of their finer feelings. Chapter 12. Dancing is unfavorable to the right relation of the sexes. A dignified freedom and familiarity of social intercourse between men and women is unquestionably for the highest good of both. Whatever tends to lower the character of their association to undignified familiarity, attitude, touch, or posture, however garnished and concealed by art, music, and public ceremonials, must be regarded as nothing less than the old serpent reappearing in our earthly Eden to poison, blight, and destroy. The proper relation of the sexes in society is one of the greatest sources of earthly happiness, just as their improper relation is one of the most prolific sources of crime and misery. The dance of modern society is based upon and finds its attraction in the fact that the sexes unite in it and are brought into such relations and positions as they would not assume but for the required formula, positions that awaken and excite emotions aroused only by the opposite sex. I freely admit that there are many exceptions to this general statement, that the regularity of the movement accompanying the music, the elegant costumes, the delightful society, and the physical exhilaration hold many to the dance with a strange fascination. But to the great majority, the excitement of unusual forms of contact with the opposite sex is the chief attraction. Many excellent people participate in the dance with no conception of the storms of wild and base passion which it excites in others, and often in those of whom they would least expect it. A live, sensitive nature must naturally be moved and stimulated by such associations as the dance secures. Only a dull, lethargic, or stupid soul would be unmoved by it. The circumstances are all powerfully suggestive. Men and women are brought into great freedom of personal contact. The exercises are such as to beget a high flow and exhilaration of animal spirits. It is night, and darkness shuts off the outer world. The delicious intoxication of harmony and music and motion fires the blood. The heaving breasts and beating hearts are brought into close contact. The warm breath upon the flushed cheek and the electric currents flowing from hand to hand or flashing from eye to eye do the work nature intended for them under lawful conditions, and no one but the superhumanly good or the naturally deficient can pass unmoved through such scenes. It is this power of exciting the sexual feelings and emotions that gives the dance its great charm to so many. I beg your pardon, gentle reader, and I tremble myself to have written so plainly, but the truth has compelled my reluctant pen to the unpleasant task. That it is the truth appears in the fact that it is impossible to sustain a dance without this association of the sexes. You may say that all social gatherings are better enjoyed where the sexes mingle, but the dance, unlike other social gatherings, cannot be maintained at all without this element. Men would turn from it with loathing if women were not to participate. The life principle of a thing, that which is essential to it, and by which it exists, is the element which still maintains it. When every other is removed, and without which it perishes, though every other remain. Applying this principle, we will find the unusual exciting contact of the sexes, the life principle of the dance without which it would perish. Footnote. The Reverend Dr. W. C. Wilkinson bears this testimony, quote, "With the sincerest reluctance I bring myself to subjoin a remark bearing on this point, once overheard on cardboard by a friend of mine in a conversation that was passing between two young men about their lady acquaintances. The horrible concreteness of the fellow's expression may give a wholesome recoil from their danger to some minds that would be little affected by a speculative statement of the same idea. Said one, I would not give a straw to dance with Miss Blank. You can't excite any more passion in her than you can in a stick of wood. Pure young women of a warmer temperament, They innocently abandon themselves to enthusiastic proclamations of their delight in a dance in the presence of gentlemen, should but barely once have a male intuition of the meaning of the involuntary glance that will often shoot across from eye to eye among their auditors, or they should overhear the comments exchanged among them afterwards. For when young men meet after an evening of the dance to talk it over together, it is not points of dress they discuss. Their only demand, and it is generally conceded, is that ladies' dress shall not needlessly embarrass suggestion. Believe me, however, women escape without the smell of fire upon their garments. Men often do not get out of the furnace, save with the flame devouring them, that they seek strange fountains and willingly damn their souls to quench, end quote. It tasks a resolutely firm nerve to speak thus of things that brazen it out before the world and the church, only for want to being thus spoken of. More innocent young girls have fallen by the opportunities afforded for approaching them improperly in the dance than from any other cause. The skillful rake considers his work half done when he has accustomed his intended victim to the touch and pressure of his hand. He may then advance by insensible degrees till his purposes are accomplished. It is one of the unsolved social enigmas how our pure, wise mothers and daughters can submit to such contact, attitudes, and movements as the dance requires, with men of whose characters they know nothing, and often with men of known bad character. It is no answer to say that only the vile think of evil. God so constituted human nature with such batteries and telegraph lines of nerves that the contact secured in the common dance is sure to send flashing along the lines to the office of passion and appetite just such messages of doubtful character as I have been speaking of. It is a question of human nature, and I must hold that a fair share of knowledge on this important subject will lead anyone to the approval of what I have here said. The rude kissing plays, and such like freedom between men and women, often found in the rural districts, are condemned on the same principle. I take it as unlawful to do anything to awaken passions or emotions that are themselves unlawful. It is freely conceded that these natural excitements may be restrained and governed, and are so restrained by great numbers, but there are many in whom they become a consuming fire, and these often are the most sensitive and gifted natures. No one has a right to subject himself and others to the strain of unnecessary temptation, nor because he is able to govern himself under temptation, to imperil others by his example who may not have the same ability to stand. Here is what a purely secular paper, the New York Journal of Education, says about dancing. Quote, "A great deal can be said about dancing. For instance, the chief of police of New York City says that 3/4 of the abandoned girls in the city were ruined by dancing. Young ladies allow gentlemen privileges in dancing which, taken under any other circumstances, would be considered as improper. It requires neither brains nor good morals to be a good dancer. As the love of dancing increases, the love of religion decreases. How many of the best men and women are skillful dancers? In ancient times, the sexes danced separately. Alcohol is the spirit of beverages, so sex is the spirit of the dance. Take it away and let the sexes dance separately, and dancing would go out of fashion very soon. Parlor dancing is dangerous. Tippling leads to drunkenness, and parlor dancing leads to ungodly balls. Tippling and parlor dancing sow to the wind, and both reap the whirlwind. Put dancing in the crucible. Apply the acids, weigh it, and the verdict of reason, morality, and religion is weighed in the balance and found wanting." A reading from the book Amusements in the Light of Reason, History, and Revelation by Samuel Milton Vernon.